Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. On tonight's show, we'll do a deep dive into what it means to radically listen to mixed-race children with Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith and Dr. Relina Joseph, authors of the new book Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids.
And we'll hear a conversation between our co-host Grace Wan and Johnny Hayes, a.k.a. Johnny Funcheap, founder of the funcheap.com event site. He'll be talking about fun and cheap things to do around the Bay Area.
But first, let's check in on the state of Oakland with Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf.
So the city of Oakland made national and international headlines last week after Mayor Schaaf announced the launch of Oakland's new guaranteed income pilot program, Oakland Resilient Families. The program, one of the largest in the nation, plans to pay 600 Oakland residents $500 a month for at least 18 months. The program follows in the footsteps of the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, also known as SEED, which found that participants reported improved employment opportunities, financial stability, and mental health after 24 months of payments under that program.
Mayor Schaaf joins us to talk about guaranteed income and other equity-building programs in Oakland. We'll also touch on Oakland Unified's reopening plan and public safety, and specifically Oakland's efforts to combat anti-Asian racism and violence. I'd like to welcome Mayor Libby Schaaf of Oakland to State of the Bay.
Great. Thanks for having me tonight. It's great to be here.
Well, we're very glad you could join us. And to start on the Oakland Basic Income Pilot Project that you've announced, so can we just start with the basics? What is a guaranteed income?
Guaranteed income really comes from the idea that we don't need just another government program. We believe in the safety net, but it is not getting people out of poverty, and it frankly is undignified. We believe that people need unconditional cash to meet their very unique needs that change over time, and also to help them chart their own path to self-sufficiency. We also think this is a racial justice tool. We see such a racial wealth gap and income gap. It is so well documented in Oakland as it is across the nation. So we think this is not just an anti-poverty measure, but a justice measure as well.
So tell us more about these 600 Oakland residents. Who qualifies for Oakland Resilient Families program?
Well, we are intentionally targeting BIPOC families, the families that have the most documented income and wealth gap. And we are focusing on families, and that will be self-defined, but a household that has a minor child living in it. We believe that that is a big bang for the buck, that the state of child poverty in California is absolutely shameful. And this is part of a national movement. I'm very proud to be a founding member of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, founded by former Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs. And it is a growing national movement. We believe that poverty is not a personal failure. It is policy failure. And that we, as a democratic society and supposedly great nation, should actually be able to end poverty, and particularly the inequitable racial wealth gap that is so well documented. And these demonstration projects around the country, each one's a little bit different. But what's exciting is that they are being rigorously studied. And this evaluation is building a body of evidence that we hope will fuel a successful advocacy effort to get the state of California and preferably the United States of America to adopt guaranteed income as an entitlement, as a permanent policy.
That's quite a vision that you outlined there. Let's get to the nuts and bolts. How is low income defined? How do families apply? Tell us how this all works.
Sure. If you want to be receiving an application or just want to get to know more or even want to chime in on the project design, you can register at OaklandResilientFamilies.org. That's the website. Very simple. Put in your email. You'll get information. We are limiting the eligibility to households with a minor child and under what we call 50% of area median income. For a family of three, that would be $59,000 a year. Now, at least half of the participants, so 300 of those 600 families, will actually be extremely low income. That means earning less than $30,000 a year for a family of three. We also are doing something a little different. We are geographically clustering one of our groups. So we're going to have two groups of 300 families. One of those groups will be geographically clustered in deep East Oakland, especially along the kind of Eastmont corridor. And that's part of our curiosity to see if geographic concentration has some added benefit. That group is also going to be using a social networking platform called Up Together. It's been developed and used by the Family Independence Initiative. They are our implementation partner. They are a national nonprofit that actually was born and raised in Oakland. So that's kind of part of what we're going to be contributing to this national conversation about guaranteed income by our specific demonstration design right here in Oakland. And then, of course, everyone can apply. We will randomly select the two groups of 300 families, and they will be receiving $500 a month, no strings attached, for at least 18 months.
And so, Mayor Schaff, you talked about the geographic clustering, but this program is also pretty different from other programs in that it's focusing exclusively on people of color, Black, Indigenous residents in Oakland. And there's been some criticism that this program is essentially racist because it is excluding white families from the program. So I'm curious what your response is to that accusation.
Well, race is always an emotional topic in America, and it's one that we need to talk about a lot more. We have well-documented racial disparities in Oakland. And I believe that by targeting the groups that are farthest from opportunity, we are actually going to help design a better program for everyone. I believe in the curb cut theory, and that's Angela Blackwell. I don't know if you've ever read her article with this example, that curb cuts on our sidewalks were designed for people who use wheelchairs. But what they found was curb cuts made sidewalks and pedestrian activity in general safer for everyone, not just wheelchair users. So when we design programs that are actually successful and are serving those who we have documented have the most barriers to self-sufficiency, have the most documented disparities, then we are designing a better program for everyone. That is our intention, and that is definitely our value here in Oakland.
So what are the goals of Oakland Resilience Families Programs, and how will you measure success here?
Well, our goals are to close the racial wealth gap and that every family thrives. That's our vision for Oakland. We are using the same evaluation team that Stockton used, and we're hoping to see a lot of the same findings. Exciting findings came out of Stockton. The idea that people who received a guaranteed income were twice as likely to get full employment than the control group who did not receive a guaranteed income. So actual total income and earnings went up because people were able to get the childcare they needed to go out and do a job interview or fix the car so they could make it to a job interview or a class that they wanted to take. They also found that people use their guaranteed income on the basic necessities of life, paying their bills, paying the rent. The other really stunning finding from the evaluation is that mental health increased tremendously. That at the beginning of the demonstration, people's stress levels, their hypertension was almost at a level that would be classified as having a mental illness. That is how stressful poverty is. But with time, the group that was receiving guaranteed income, their stress went down, their depression went down, their overall well-being and health improved tremendously, particularly when compared to the control group that did not receive a guaranteed income. And that is something that we truly hope to see, especially for parents who have that added stress of wanting to take care of their children. So that's what we're excited to see, and that's what we're going to be documenting.
And over what time period do you expect to see these findings if they are, in fact, noticeable?
We have sufficient funding, and I just want to stress that this funding is all entirely privately raised to support these 600 families for an 18-month period. I hope, like Stockton, people get excited about this demonstration and that perhaps we're able to raise some additional resources to extend the demonstration for at least another 6 months to 2 years. But right now, at least 18 months is the time period that we're looking at to see what we believe will be some dramatic improvements in outcomes and the ability to move to self-sufficiency.
And Mayor Schaff, just on this point, you mentioned it's privately funded. And just last question on this pilot project here is, what's the broader vision then if these are privately funded programs? I know the Stockton one was privately funded as well. Is the hope here that the federal government is eventually going to start funding programs like this? Where do you see this going if success is able to be documented?
Unequivocally, yes. We believe, and this is part of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, that it should be a federal policy that Americans should have an income floor, and that instead of yet another program, that unconditional flexible cash is the fastest way to get people to self-sufficiency and to also stop robbing people of their dignity. I'll give you one other example, and this is part of what got me so excited. When Michael Tubbs texted me and said, hey, do you have any interest in joining this? I like immediately responded and said, hell yes. And it's because we had been working with something called Keep Oakland Housed, and it's trying to prevent homelessness before it starts. And not only are we giving people one-time emergency cash to pay back rent so they can avoid eviction, but what we found is people are making horrible choices. They maybe paid the rent, but they are living with no electricity or running water because they weren't able to pay their utility bills. Or one story that I'll never forget. It was a man who was developmentally disabled and his elderly mother. And they had been stably housed because he was working, but their washing machine broke. And because of that, he was unable to keep his work uniform clean. And because of his disability, he was unable to navigate a public laundromat. So not only did we pay their back bills and their rent and avoid their eviction, but we bought them a washing machine so that the man could go back to work and stay stably housed after that one-time assistance. There is no government program for washing machines. And that's just one little example about the government does not know everything a family needs at every moment to actually become self-sufficient.
Well, we'll definitely be tracking the progress of this pilot program. Very interested to see what the results are from it. I wanted to pivot to the issue of school reopenings. And we know that you don't directly control what the Oakland School District does. But at the same time, we have a lot of listeners who are very interested in living in Oakland or have relatives in the Oakland schools, nephews, nieces, et cetera. I'm just curious, then, what's the plan on reopening? I mean, teachers were incentivized to volunteer to come back to the classroom with prioritized vaccinations and a stipend by mid-April. And now it looks like some of that is in jeopardy as some of the teachers are not planning to come back. What is your view on this situation? What can you tell Oakland parents and others who are interested in what the outcome might be here?
Listen, I know that this has been an extremely emotional issue. I'm a parent of two school kids myself. And so I know how badly people want kids back in school, how we're seeing this not just have an academic impact on them, but the social emotional impact on kids has been visceral. At the same time, I believe we need to give each other grace. And I think that the deal that was worked out between the district and union leaders was a great deal. And that's because in this moment, I believe offering people choice, as we are still in a moment of such uncertainty, vaccinations are picking up, but we're still uncertain about how they're going to interact with the variants. I actually think this deal was good because it gave parents choice about whether they felt comfortable with sending their children back, and it also gave teachers some choice. I am disappointed that the number of teachers that are willing, that volunteered to come back, that made that choice, is not quite sufficient to match the need of the students that wanted to come back, especially our highest need students. And in middle schools and high schools, the hope was to serve our unhoused students, our students in foster care, our English language learners, the students that really, really need to be back in in-person learning. I know that over time, things will evolve, and at some point, there may be a requirement. I am feeling hopeful that tomorrow we should be in the orange tier for Alameda County based on our case rates and our equity indicators. So I'm hopeful that with time, people will feel more and more comfortable. But I respect that the deal that we have now really does honor choice of both families and teachers.
So we want to move next to talking about public safety. In the almost year since the murder of George Floyd, there's been lots of discussion about how we address police budgets. And you've been critical of budget cuts to the police department in the past. And public safety is unfortunately an evergreen topic in Oakland, including among Oakland's Asian American residents who are concerned about the rise in anti-Asian racism and violence. What is your take on what it's going to take to keep Oakland's Asian American communities safe?
Well, I think we need to keep all of our communities safe. And certainly the rise in hate against our Asian American community and our Asian immigrant community has been heartbreaking. But we know that crime has been going on in Oakland and has been disproportionately affecting many communities, especially the Black community, for years and years and years. I believe that there is tremendous unity in the idea that we must invest more in non-police response and non-police forms of public safety, as well as addressing the root causes of crime. And that is certainly something that we're committed to doing. I think Guaranteed Income is actually an example of that. Where I think it gets much more divisive is the question specifically about police services. And in Oakland, it's always been a divisive issue. It's gotten more so since the state-sponsored murder of George Floyd, a horrific tragedy. And I certainly hope that justice is delivered in that case. We're all watching that right now. But it has been a very robust debate. I was actually fascinated when we did a very deep survey of Oakland residents to get their take on different spending priorities for the city. And it was just a very small minority that actually wanted to see fewer police services with regard to 911 response and police patrols. Only 15% of Oaklanders responded that they wanted fewer police services. And it was pretty consistent across race and age, except actually, young white people in much greater numbers want fewer police. Older Asian people in much greater numbers wanted more police, a lot more police. And those were the two outliers in this survey of Oakland residents that was done at the end of this fiscal year as part of our budget process. Mm-hmm. So it continues to be a divisive issue. The thing I don't think is divisive is standing up something like MACRO, where people have an option for a non-police response to a 911 call, especially something involving a mental health crisis. That is the kind of police replacement or supplement, depending on what your feelings are, that I think we must accelerate, because that's the path to providing a more holistic delivery of public safety.
And Mayor Schaff, we only have a few seconds left, but I wanted to end on a potentially lighter note, which is that the baseball season is starting next week. The A's will be opening up against the Dodgers. And if you've been, I know you've been following this, but for the listeners following the news, the A's have a new proposed ballpark at the Howard Terminal waterfront area. They just released their draft environmental impact report on that. What do you see as the likely next steps? Just 30 seconds here for that project.
Well, we want to see some really robust community benefits, and that means affordable housing, environmental standards. That's the next step, and I know our city councilors is going to demand that before they approve a project, but we are getting close to having a project ready for approval by the end of this year, but it's got to be good for Oakland, not just now, but long into the future.
All right. Well, you heard what it takes to play ball then on that ballpark proposal. Mayor Schaaf, we have so much more we could ask you about, but we got to cut it off there. Thanks so much for joining us in State of the Bay.
Great. You have a great night. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll have a conversation with Dr. Allison Briscoe Smith and Dr. Relina Joseph about their new book, Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids. Are you a parent? Oh, there you are. You're muted there.
It's the usual 2021. Are you on Zoom? Are you on mute? So if you're parenting a mixed race child, we would love to hear from you. We want to hear about how you're talking to your kids, or more importantly, listening to your kids talk about their racial identity.
As always, we want you to be a part of the conversation. Give us a call with your questions and comments at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message. We're on Twitter at State of Bay.
Now on State of the Bay. Generation Z is the most racially and ethnically diverse generation the United States has ever seen. According to the 2010 census, nearly 50% of young people born after 1996 are racial or ethnic minorities, and a significant portion of those kids are of mixed race.
While multiracial children often see themselves reflected positively in the media and in leadership positions, they're also flooded with images and stories of racialized violence. And their own experiences with identity and race may go unheard in their homes or schools. In addition, little has been known about how mixed race children develop their racial identity or how they may be impacted by implicit bias. Until now.
So here tonight to share advice with parents, educators, and school administrators on how best to listen to and support the development of mixed race children are the authors of the new book, Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids. We're very pleased to be joined by Dr. Allison Briscoe Smith, a clinical psychologist and the director of diversity, equity, and inclusion at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. Welcome, Allison.
Thank you.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Dr. Relina Joseph, professor of communication, and the director of the Center for Communication, Difference, and Equity, and an associate dean of diversity, equity, and inclusion at the University of Washington in Seattle. Welcome, Relina.
Hi there.
Well, welcome to the both of you. Dr. Joseph, I wanted to start with you. When and why did you and Dr. Briscoe Smith decide to write this book discussing this topic?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. Well, first off, this book is incredibly personal, and we go into the book in a really personal way. Allison and I aren't just co-authors. We are godmothers to each other's children and godmothers to each other's mixed race children. And so questions and conversations about mixed race or mixed race kids have been a part of our lives since we were roommates together in a dissertation writing retreat way 20 years ago. So it felt like it was the right time. I was having conversations with Dr. James Banks, who is a father of multicultural education. And interestingly enough, in this amazing series, this multicultural education series that he had written, it had 60-something titles, and there was not one on mixed race. And so we realized that there was a gap that we could fill. And by bringing Allison's voice as a psychologist, a developmental clinical psychologist, my work in critical mixed race studies, so we could really tell a special story.
So, Allison, your book integrates narratives from mixed race children, their parents, and a few select teachers. And you talk a lot about what's called radical listening, and you provide some exercises. We'll get to more of that as we talk more in the next few moments. Tell us, though, how you two decided to structure the book in this way, and how did you end up bringing those voices to you?
Well, we always had an interest of really centering on and focusing on the experiences of the children themselves. And Relina can tell a little bit more about the particular methodology, but it's a methodology that it really speaks to my heart as a clinical psychologist of deeply listening. So we actually had children speak to each other. And the story is we had an outline, an idea for the book, but we really listened to the kids and then we actually had them listen to themselves. We had them report out in these big listening sessions that were really important. And then we had to revise the book. We had to really lean in and think, oh, you know, our supposed structure changed once you actually listen to what the children are saying and as we heard their experiences. So it was an iterative process, one that we actually try to take the idea of radically listening and apply it to our method, apply it to the literature, apply it to the kids. So we had to do it a couple different times to really listen and to be willing to be wrong sometimes. Oh, that structure didn't really work. Let's try something else.
Sounds like you were radically listening in terms of even how you're writing the book, if you were changing it as you were going along. Well, I mentioned in the intro to this section that the 2010 census has described this as the most racially diverse generation born after 1996 that we've ever had in the United States. Can you describe a bit more about the demographics of generation mixed within that census and a little more detail on this demographic in this country?
Yeah, so we call this book Generation Mixed, and Generation Mixed comes from that, you know, the Loving generation would be those of us like myself that were born after the Loving versus Virginia decision in 1967 that legalized interracial marriage. But the Generation Mixed generation comes after the Check One or More decision on the 2000 census, right, where for the first time parents really of multiracial kids were able to check all the options, or you as an adult were able to check all the options for yourself. So colloquially, we didn't come up with the term, it's colloquially where that comes from. And we know that there are certain pockets of the country, while there certainly the country is becoming more diverse and it's becoming more multiracial, there are certain areas that are far more multiracial than others. And where we conducted our research in Seattle, Washington, you know, is the second most multiracial city in the country. And we know that the Bay Area, where you all are, is incredibly mixed as well. And that, you know, there are different places, Brooklyn, New York, there are certain places in the country that are incredibly mixed, and it looks different depending on what area you're in. Here in Seattle, there's actually not a plurality of a certain type of mixed race folks. There are almost equal numbers of people that are multiracial Asian and multiracial African American. And, you know, it really kind of depends on where in the country you are. And maybe we can talk a little bit in a minute about why it's important to actually not use that term multiracial without a descriptor of some other racializing term, which is one of the things that Alice and I drill down on a bit in the book.
Well, why don't we just go there right now? It's important that we have the right definitions. Just go ahead and sketch that out for us.
Yeah, so one of the reasons why we want to use that term is because it's also the language of what the kids say. So again, part of this was really listening to what they wanted to how they wanted to describe themselves. And we found through this listening, which again is supported somewhat in terms of parts of the research, but really emphasize in terms of what the kids say, they identified with that racial specifier. Most of the kids that we interviewed, and there weren't a whole lot of kind of, we're not trying to come up with generalities, but one generality is that kids would say things like, I'm Black and mixed, or I'm multiracial Asian. It was the language that the children were offering. So, and when I say children, we're talking about kids 7, 8, 9, all the way up through a lot of adolescence. So really folks that are kind of crossing over into adulthood. And so listening to them and the movements that we see and hear from them is where they're using that as the language to describe themselves, which we feel is really important.
Staying with you, Allison, help us understand how the children came to create that identity for themselves. What is it about their experiences in day-to-day life, whether it be in their families, at home, in the schools, on the playground, media, that sort of shapes how they see themselves and the labels they choose to don?
Well, really what we saw was that children were impacted by racism around them. And there was one girl who I think about who says and identified as Black. She says, I'm Black and I'm mixed, but I walk through the world as a Black person. I'm treated as a Black person. And she was 9. So we're talking about a level of kind of sophistication and awareness that often parents don't hold on to about how kids are treated. So we really want to focus on how kids identify themselves. And that also means that they're pushed and pulled by other factors. How are they treated? What kind of neighborhood are they in? Who do they spend time with? And one of the big things that we heard is that multiracial kids change over time. I went to this school where I was really Black. I went to this school where I was really Filipina. I went to this school where this happened. So listening to the agency that these kids have is really important. So all of those factors are there, but so often we as adults are kind of coming up with a label to place on them. So we'd rather have them generate it themselves.
Just want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, along with Ethan Elkine. And we're talking with Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith and Dr. Relina Joseph, authors of the new book, Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids. Are you a mixed race child or parenting or teaching one? Do you have experiences or questions to share? We want you to join our conversation. You could do so by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay.
And so, Dr. Briscoe-Smith, I wanted to follow up on something you were talking about just at the end about how these kids sort of come to identify themselves in relation to their situation. And so my question is, how would you define racial socialization and how mixed race children come to understand race and develop their own racial identity?
So we understand racial socialization as the process by which parents are trying to communicate, talk to, shape the ways that children come to understand themselves. So we often talk about it in terms of what they say, but it's not only what they say, it's what they do, where they choose to live, what schools they choose to go, but it's the entire process that we, again, are thinking about in terms of what parents are doing. So that's one factor. There are other factors. What are peers doing? What are family doing? What is the, again, neighborhood and community? But racial socialization in general is what we're talking about with what parents can do.
And what do you see as the positive or negative impacts of this racial socialization?
They can be impacts that are really broad and wide ranging. The reason why I kind of speak about moving beyond talking is that the majority of parents writ large aren't speaking about race. That changes when you get to kids of color. So there are different options that can happen there, positive and negative, but not being silent is a big point.
And so... Yeah, go ahead. Relina, did you want to say something? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to add there, you know, one of the interesting things that we see is this gap in particular. You know, we have white parents that are parenting kids of color. And they're, you know, as Allison said, families of color are speaking more about race. But what happens when you have a white mother in particular, a white parent, and the mother is usually in charge of all kinds of different types of socialization, in charge of talking about race. And that's incredibly uncomfortable. And she doesn't have the language. And in fact, she is really offended by the thought of her child identifying as Black. So we had a case like that, for example, that, you know, of a son and a mother that came into our studio and were sharing stories together. And when a parent is not used to talking about race, is not conversant, and that's a white person who has a child of color, that can be incredibly harmful. And in fact, this little boy who was 11 at the time ends up crying in the interview as he keeps on trying to defend his own racial identity choice, and she refuses to hear him.
So tell us more about this dynamic in a multiracial household. You touched on it briefly there by talking about how a white parent may have certain particular notions of what their child's racial identity is or should be. Help us understand what is going on in the household when people have obviously been intentional often about having a mixed race child, whether through adoption or the natural way. But how is it that this is an area where people are stumbling?
Well, I mean, one of the things that happens is that there's this idea that perhaps folks have transcended race. Look, we've beat it. We're a multiracial family. We've transcended race. Our kids are ambiguous. You can't tell. So, and we understand that that's a place of kind of hope that somehow your kids would not be impacted by racism. But that hope is somewhat deafening and doesn't allow people to really, sometimes, really listen. So we had multiple cases like the one that Relina mentioned where kids were saying, hey, I'm this. And parents were struggling with that. But no, you're not really like that. You're not Black in that kind of way. You're not Filipino in that kind of way. So that's a dissonance, and that's not listening to the kids' experience. So what can happen, right, is, and what we're trying to encourage with the exercises, et cetera, in our literature is let's lean in, let's slow down, let's get uncomfortable, but let's listen to what our children are saying such that we're not having households where our hope is, look, we beat racism, or we're all done. We don't have evidence that we're all done.
And I wanted to follow up on a comment you made, just teeing off of what Joseph picked up on as well, which is this idea of a white parent and a Black mixed race child who identifies as Black, and how that can create tension. And you noted, and this is for you, Dr. Briscoe-Smith, that in the book, that mixed race children who are Black often are racialized as Black and then therefore face a specific set of challenges as a result. And I'm wondering if you could describe those challenges and why those differences exist compared to other mixed race children.
So one of the lenses that we pay attention to is that of implicit bias. And so what we find is that kids who are seen as kids of color along the lines of colorism, but along the lines of being seen as kids of color, are subject to implicit biases, which are often negative. So that research in terms of implicit biases is really robust, and it's emerging in the field of multiracial kids, where multiracial kids, if they're seen as kids of color, are just as subject to those biases, those prejudices. And if not, especially in the case of multiracial kids, if they're not quote unquote identifiable to the reader, it really actually slows people down cognitively. They get frustrated. I can't understand who you are. What are you? Let me categorize you. That has big consequences.
Well, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm here with Joseph Pache, and you're listening to State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. We're speaking with Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith and Dr. Relina Joseph, authors of the new book, Generation Mixed Goes to School, Radically Multiracial Kids. And we'd love to invite you to join this conversation. If you have questions, please feel free to ring us at the number 866-798-TALK. If you have questions about how to support mixed race children, any advice to offer, that's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Well, Dr. Joseph, let me go to you on this idea of radically listening. And so let's take a scenario we just described where mixed race children who might identify as Black are facing a specific set of challenges. What would be your advice to a parent in that situation or a teacher who needs to radically listen to that child? What would be some of the techniques and tips you might offer?
Yeah. So part of what we talk about in radically listening is to place your full intention on the speaker and to try and not imbue that speaker with your hopes or with your guilt, with your pride, perhaps, in terms of parents, but really to hear them and to hear them out fully and completely. And we know that, especially when it comes to race, that all the emotions that I just named are often overlaid, you know, on top of race. And to sit in the discomfort that Allison was talking about, and we use the term that Jennifer Eberhardt uses, which is called friction. So we said that, and other scholars talk about, is sitting in the fire. So really kind of developing your tolerance to hear and to hold that perspective that might be so different from your own. And it might be that I don't read you as the way in which you're racializing yourself, but I need to hear your racialized experience, to hear why you identify this way, and I need to honor that.
And Allison, I wanted to go back to something that I think it was you that said this earlier. I'm sorry, I can't remember, about the strategies or how children's identity changes from stage to stage in their lives. I think you call this shape shifting. When I read about that, it made me think of another term that often is used around sort of a contextual identity, that being code switching. Could you help us understand what are the connections between the two, if any?
So, I mean, the idea at its base is that kids, people, are context dependent, and we seek out belonging in many different ways. So how is it that I can belong in this setting? So does that mean that I shift and change? Does that mean I alter my speech? So I like to think about it as thinking about what do we do to figure out that we can actually belong in this moment. But I think Relina might be able to speak a little bit about some of the technicalities around code switching a bit more than I can. But, you know, the idea again comes down to how do we belong in the situation that we all seek, that that's a very human need.
Yeah, I think that you said it beautifully, Allison. And I think that, you know, one of the things that Allison's pointing out here that I think that we try and do in the book is to say, these are things that we are noticing with mixed race kids, but these are things that many of us do. Many of us do, whether or not we're monoracial and people of color, if we're monoracial and white. We need to pay attention to power. We need to pay attention to identity. We need to pay attention to change. And so I think that that's why there are parts in our book that are really relevant for all different types of families and all different types of people who want to explore race and racialized identity.
But as a white person, I know that I have the privilege that I don't have to necessarily read a room when I walk into it, right? But someone of color really has to size up the situation pretty much from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. This is actually my second book was on this. So I talk about a theory called strategic ambiguity and how Black women in particular walk into a space and have to read it for safety. But I think that even that the type of, you know, so-called freedom of walking into a room and that privilege is something that we all are working to name in various ways right now and to be really conscious and cognizant of. That's a performance as well, right? That's a performance of power as well that we need to see, just as Allison and I might have to go in and figure out how do we soften our voice? How do we make a connection with this person so that we can have our voices be heard? We all have to do this in various ways. For some of us, it might look so-called natural. For others of us, it might look more like a performance, but really we want to see this as performative for all of us.
So lots and lots for the kids to be thinking and processing constantly. And I think what's coming out for me in this conversation so far is that we've forgotten or haven't even thought of, to tell you the truth, that mixed race children are navigating these waters just as much, if not more, than other people of color, because there's been no space for them to really come out and talk about this and have their particular needs addressed.
Well, we hear from the kids in particular, one of the things that was a theme is because we asked the kids, what is it that you want? What do you want people to know about your experiences? Many of them actually spoke about, it's great when I get to spend time with other mixed kids, with other multiracial kids, when I get to be in those spaces. Or even we heard kids say things like, huh, as I think about it, all of my friends are mixed like me. So looking again for that place of belonging so that there is a spaciousness to talk about the complexity of the navigation that we're talking about. You know, I want to be careful that we don't over-pathologize the work, which is actually a tendency that has happened within the literature. You know, that poor kid that had to do all that work, you must be confused. That's not what we're seeing. We don't have evidence around that. It's complex, but it's resilient, it's moving, it's agentic, and having spaces, that still means we need to have spaces where people can understand that, where people can come together and talk about that, especially in the educational system, which is what we're kind of targeting. We want schools to be able to create spaces where kids can come together. We want teachers to be able to hold on to and think about centering the experiences of these kids as well.
Thanks for that reframe.
Yeah, well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Adam calling in from Oakland. So, Adam, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to offer ideas for parents who are parenting mixed children. I am mixed myself. I'm about 50 years old, and I was raised but with both my white and black parents. And I can say the only thing that is keeping me together, and it seems to be getting more difficult, and I do have these worries and concerns for my son, is that I definitely had extended family on both the white and black side that allowed me to have an identity where I felt comfortable in a room full of black people and a room full of white people. I also had cousins that were mixed as well. But outside of that, growing up, I never really found a space to be, like you just were mentioning, not having a space. That was a kind of something you're going to struggle with. And I don't know if it's going to be the same for my son here in Oakland. There are a lot of mixed kids around and maybe in Seattle. But I would say for the vast majority of the country, you're going to be a mixed kid who has to navigate, you know, unmixed spaces. And if you don't have the comfort level within yourself to be around a group of people, you're constantly going to be wondering what they're thinking about you, how they're seeing you, and how they're judging you. And really having my extended family be close to me and accept me was really important. So I would offer any parents with mixed kids to really make sure that you keep in touch with your family and that your kids grow up around both sides of your family.
Adam, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your experience. Like, that really helps personalize this. And just direct this to Dr. Joseph. Any quick thoughts and reaction to Adam's experience here?
Yeah, no, I really appreciate hearing that. And yeah, absolutely, just co-sign everything that he said. Being able to be around family and to find out who you are is huge. And the part of the way in which schools can do this, and we talk a little bit about how this I'm forgetting the term that we use, Allison, our socialization, affinity groups, fictive kin.
Yeah.
We use some type of fictive kin or something in there. So how schools can do this by creating affinity groups. So spaces where kids can come together and see each other, not just multiracial kids, other BIPOC kids, LGBTQ kids. We talk to schools who do this really well, that bring together kids who are adopted. Right, kids who have a minoritized experience in an educational setting and need to come and see a reflection of themselves.
So we have less than a minute to go. We've talked a lot about what teachers and parents can do, how people can seek out peer support. How about the rest of us who don't have a mixed race child, don't know one in an intimate way, but want to understand how to participate to create that space for them? What would you give our listeners who might be in that situation in terms of advice?
Read the book. No. So yes. And I mean, the thing is to kind of listen for and pay attention to the folks around you. Multiracial folks are all around. You know, it's not going to be hard, especially in our communities, to reach out and connect to those folks. And again, what we're really inviting people to do is listen. So maybe you didn't realize that person was multiracial. Maybe you want to, you know, read books, fiction, watch art, listen to music that's kind of created, and kind of just even listen and expand the repertoire. Because what we're really asking for is to expand our circles of belonging. That's what the kids really asked us to do. That's what they charged us with. So that's the invitation that we really want to make, is to look around, listen, and expand that invitation.
Well, we've got to, unfortunately, bring this to a close. But before we do, Relina, I'll ask you, where can listeners find the book?
They can find it at all their favorite booksellers. So certainly at Amazon. We would like to direct people to their local booksellers or online to TC Press, Teachers College Press.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Dr. Allison Briscoe-Smith and Dr. Relina Joseph, the authors of the new book, Generation Mixed, Goes to School, Radically Listening to Multiracial Kids. Thank you both so much for joining us, Dr. Joseph and Dr. Briscoe-Smith.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Next up, our co-host Grace Wan sits down with Johnny Hayes, also known as Johnny Funcheap, founder of the Funcheap.com events site. He's going to chat about arts and events happening around the Bay Area. Stay tuned. This is State of the Bay.
Next up, we have host Grace Wan's conversation with San Francisco's own Johnny Hayes, also known as Johnny Funcheap, about fun things to do in the Bay Area right now. It's been a long year of wearing masks and social distancing, but there are exciting things going on out there that you can safely do. Check it out.
I'm State of the Bay host Grace Wan, and tonight I'm talking to Johnny Hayes, also known as Johnny Funcheap. Johnny is a Bay Area bargain guru and the founder of FunCheapSF.com. Welcome to the State of the Bay, Johnny.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, before we start getting into where to go and what to do in the Bay Area, I'm curious, how is quarantine for you?
Well, for me, quarantine was not much different than before. I spend most of my time in front of my computer. But for running the business, it was obviously a major, major shift since almost every event was canceled. So FunCheap sort of shifted away temporarily from being an events discovery website to a resource guide of senior hours at grocery stores, where to get tested, making sure that we could cut through all of the hard to read information that the city and the state gave and try to put it together in a meaningful, useful, easy to read way. So that's been the major change. And as events come back, we'll continue to include a lot of this public service information.
What a great resource for the community. Well, San Francisco and a lot of the Bay Area moved into the orange tier recently. What does that mean for folks who want to be out and about?
Yeah, the change to the orange tier was actually quite a big change. Indoor dining got expanded to 50%. And also bars, for the first time in a year, have been allowed to open. Previously, bars have had to do sort of a dance where they have to serve a bona fide meal. This time with the orange tier, it's the first time that bars can serve outdoors and there is no food requirement anymore. Mm. One of the other big changes is that live music and performances are now officially allowed. Previously, you couldn't have live singing. Now those rules have changed where as long as the performers and the singers are 12 feet away, then they are allowed to now sing and do performances. And one other change that's happening is that music and performances outdoors are now allowed up to 50 people. There are some caveats. Social distancing is required. The event has to be organized and supervised, and the organizer has to actually submit a health plan. So you can't just invite 50 people to the park. It has to be organized. But that's a major change. Previously, that just wasn't allowed at all.
Focusing on what's fun and what's cheap, tell me some experiences that I can have right now in the Bay Area.
One of my favorite organizations is the San Francisco City Guides. They are walking tours. And this is a really fun way to start engaging and finding new communities. Mm. The City Guide tours are free. They ask for donations. You know, they have things like the Golden Gate Bridge, discovering hidden stairways. One of my favorite ones is the flowers and tunnels of Golden Gate Park. So I think that's a really fun way to sort of reintegrate yourself back with life. One of the other cool things that's happening is the roller skating scene. There is a location in San Francisco called the Skatin' Place. It's in Golden Gate Park at around 6th Avenue, and every Sunday afternoon they have a roller disco party. They have a mobile DJ, and there's usually somebody there who will teach you choreographed roller disco moves. And in Oakland, there's a new park that opened in November called Township Commons in Brooklyn Basin. And this park has amazing views of Alameda and San Francisco, and that has become a new roller skating hub for the East Bay. So if you want to try to learn roller disco, learn a new skill, then Brooklyn Basin in Oakland is another fantastic place. It's the first of 5 new public parks planned in Oakland.
Well, that is definitely bringing me back to my childhood and watching people do some roller disco. So do you have any recommendations of places to experience the beauty of the Bay Area?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways that you can experience really fun things outdoors. In Half Moon Bay, there's a place called Limos Farm, and they have goat yoga classes outdoors. It's a casual outdoor yoga class, except for the fact that they have 15 to 20 goats that are wandering around. If you're feeling particularly friendly, you can actually get one of the goats on your back while you're doing your poses. Or you can just ignore them completely. And then afterwards, there's about 15 minutes where you can do petting and feeding time. So those tickets are about $35, and they happen on Saturday and Sunday mornings. One other fun outdoor activity that is in Ocean Beach in San Francisco, it's called Large Scale Sand Art, the Earthscape art experience. There are local artists that will teach small groups, up to 15 people, how to create massive beach art using rakes. And the beauty of it is that you create the art with other people, and then at the end of the day, you watch as the waves wash away your artwork.
That is very zen. Well, I think another thing I know I've missed is going into a movie theater and watching a film. I've heard of drive-in movie pop-ups. Are those still happening?
Yeah, there are actually quite a few drive-in movie theaters in the Bay Area. One of the biggest pop-up ones is at Fort Mason in San Francisco, and they have movies there almost every day of the week. Also, there's two drive-in movie theaters that have been here the whole time. One of them is in Concord. And then in San Jose, there's a permanent drive-in theater called the Capital Six that has six different screens. One of the most fun things that's happening at a drive-in is the San Francisco Opera is doing performances. Starting in April, they're actually going to do live performances for the first time at the fairgrounds at the Marin Center in San Rafael. I run a website called Fun Cheap. I list a lot of fun and free things to do and affordable. This is not that, but I think it's a great idea nonetheless. So they're going to be doing a live performance of The Barber of Seville on the stage at the Marin Center starting April 23rd.
One thing I think people don't realize about your site, which is really extensive, you also include protests. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so right when the Black Lives Matter protests began last year, we started compiling lists. They're very difficult to find. Some of them are on Instagram, some of them only on Twitter, some of them only flyers that are posted up. And so we tried to compile a robust list that we update every single day with either protests, rallies, vigils, volunteering events. And now with a lot of Stop Asian Hate events coming up, we're publishing a lot of those types of rallies and vigils in San Francisco and all throughout the Bay Area.
So let me ask you this. What are you excited about?
There's a couple things coming up. One is that the Pride Festival is coming back, not the big parade and block party that we're used to, but they're going to be having Pride in San Francisco, a bunch of live smaller events that's going to be June 11th and 12th. Last year, the Pride Festival was virtual. This year, it's coming back slowly in person. And so I'm really excited to see these really important institutions of San Francisco and the Bay Area start to come back in a way that people can join together safely. One other great event that I'm loving is called Bayside Saturdays. And it takes place in San Francisco every Saturday in April. And it's a way to rediscover the waterfront of India Basin and Hunter's Point. So there's going to be a bunch of free fitness classes, live music, and DJs at Speakeasy Brewery. Plus, you'll be able to see a bunch of new murals from Black and Bayview-based artists all along the walking and biking path.
Well, I have to say, these have been great recommendations, and I want to say thanks so much for being with us on State of the Bay, Johnny.
I really appreciate you having me.
Tonight, I've been talking to Johnny Hayes, also known as Johnny Fun Cheap, the Bay Area bargain guru and founder of FunCheapSF.com. For more details and dates of the events that Johnny mentioned, check out his website, FunCheapSF.com.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week.
We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being a part of the conversation.
And so, Joseph, what do we have on deck for next week?
Next week, we talk about San Francisco schools, the homeless crisis in San Francisco, and, of course, we hear your interview with San Francisco artist Jennifer Wofford about her new mural in the Tenderloin. If you have questions for any of our guests next week, email us at stateofbay@gmail.com or send us a tweet at stateofbay.
And for a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our State of the Bay page on KALW.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Ann Harper.
And we've been back on the air now for 3 weeks as the new State of the Bay. And a huge thanks to Jeffrey Burke-Witten of Logo Man, who designed our new look pro bono. And many thanks especially to David Boyer for his hours of leadership and inspiration. Thank you so much, Jeffrey and David.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Ethan Elkind.
Good night, and thanks for listening.
Have a great week.